all cases, very high scintillation yields. So 30,000-ish photons per MeV. Maybe this actually number, maybe more like 50 or 60 in xenon, it seems, based on recent data. And a key point is that the noble liquids don't absorb their own scintillation light. It's energetically forbidden. Because the scintillation light comes from the radiative decay of noble liquid excimers, diatomic molecules. And they fluoresce at a wavelength that can't be, or an energy that can't be absorbed by the first, by the atomic gas. So these are transparent to their own scintillation light, which means that you can build big detectors and still have a low threshold. And it turns out that the quenching factors, or LF, are relatively modest for nuclear recoils. I mean, we've been pushing it pretty hard in the case of liquid xenon, but it's amazing that we've gotten down the thresholds we could. I remember, you know, around 2000, big skepticism on xenon was, well, we're never going to get enough signal, you know, to be able to go to a low threshold. So xenon, I mean, a lot of people said xenon would never work. It would take some effort to get past that hurdle in the early part of the decade.
So the dimer that you mentioned that makes its own light and therefore transparent to the rest, is it also true for the helium?
It's true for all of them.
All of them have.
Yeah, they share that physics. The physics is very similar for all of these. The numbers are different. The physics is very similar. And obviously we can build big detectors by building a bigger vessel and filling it with instrumentation. So here's just a summary. Different noble gases, lightest to heaviest. Less dense, most dense, boiling point, lowest to highest, and so on. Really, the biggest differences between the noble liquids from a dark matter search perspective are the radioactivity. Okay, that's important and very different for different gases. And also this triplet molecule lifetime. The excimers that fluoresce come in singlet states and triplet states. And for the triplet states to decay, you have to drive a spin flip in the molecule. And that there's pretty strong spinorbital coupling in the xenon, but very, very little in the helium, for example. So while the scintillation all comes out in 30 nanoseconds or so in xenon, it can take as long as 13 seconds to come out in helium. So there's an enormous range of scintillation timescales. And in papers early in the decade, we pointed out that neon and argon are sort of perfect for PM pulse shape discrimination because in the same event, you could see this microsecond light coming out, easy to correlate with the fast light, and basically a different separate signal that you can quantify. And that's what's led to this fantastic pulse shape discrimination in liquid argon. Now, argon, as you just heard, is slightly radioactive, which is the main drawback to argon. Argon is fantastic in terms of discrimination power and cost and so on. And krypton's impossible because krypton is very radioactive. Like a mega becquerel per kilogram. Yes?
No, so regarding the fact that it has a much longer lifetime,
I'll be talking about the helium quite a bit later. And xenon, the only internal radioactivity is from xenon 136, which, as we now know, has a 2 neutrino double beta decay lifetime. It's now finally been measured. But obviously, that's negligible for xenon dark matter searches. A key approach, a real change in approach, based, the dark matter direct detection game has mostly been about, take your small detector, work on it really hard, get the discrimination good enough so that you have essentially no background, and only then make it bigger, right? And then work really hard on that bigger scale to do the same thing and so on. So there's been a bit of a paradigm shift, which is that for these big detectors, the bigger you make the detector, the lower your gamma and neutron rate in an absolute sense because of self-shielding. If you have a big detector and their backgrounds are mostly coming from the walls, those have to penetrate in, and in many cases, if they scatter twice, you can easily reject that event. And you can imagine that the chance that a gamma ray comes in, small angle scatters, to deposit a small amount of energy in the WIMP energy region of interest, and then escapes without scattering any, I mean, it drops exponentially with the detector diameter of the scattering length. And that's why as we build these things bigger, we improve exponentially in sensitivity. So a lot of early thinking about that on clean and also X-mass collaboration using the xenon. Okay, so you heard from Guillaume about the liquid xenon technology. Again, there's the themes of this time projection chamber approach, which is very beautiful, is that you get, if you have an event, you get both prompt light, which we call S1, and proportional light from the charge, which we call S2. When the electrons get pulled into the gas and caused to proportionally scintillate. And then the ratio of S2 to S1 gives us discrimination power at the order of 99 to 99.99% discrimination, depending on what electric field you're applying to the xenon. So, and then the time between these events gives you the depth of the event and the distribution of this light, and the top phototube array gives you S1. So, and terrific position resolution. And so this is really taking the field by storm, and now we have multiple collaborations all working on this similar technology. And then the more recent thing is that there's basically more consensus emerging that this LF parameter, the amount of light from a nuclear recoil per unit energy compared to an electron recoil, actually drops at lower energy. And there was some controversy about what this does over the last couple of years, but now, based on our results at Yale and recent results at Columbia, and also the newer calibrations from Zeppelin 3, basically indicate that this is indeed dropping at low energy, which makes it harder if you're just using, if you're using a prompt light to really push very low in wind mass. And then I would say, in the longer term, the most promising approach to getting very low wind mass sensitivity is this charge-only analysis. And there, of course, you give up on discrimination power, okay, because you can't use this ratio of charge to light. It's also hard to figure out the depth of your event. However, it looks like the because the electron cloud diffuses as it drifts up to the liquid xenon, the width in time, you know, you think, if you look at the S2 signal, you're taking slices of that electron cloud in Z, projecting that onto time, and the width of that signal in time actually can tell you the depth of the event, just with some accuracy. So there's, I mean, some nice studies of how that would work. And as these detectors get bigger, and there's basically less and less background in the middle of the detector because of self-shielding, this is going to continue to be a very powerful technique for getting low wind mass sensitivity. And then the key question there is exactly how much charge do you get for these very low energy nuclear recoils? And these are tricky measurements. Some measurements here with neutron scattering give you an idea for what the measurements give you so far, down to charge for unit energy. And then there's a fair amount of modeling work, consistent with the data, with physically plausible models that give you sort of a range of charge response in liquid xenon. So these are all depend on, of course, the Linhart factor, which makes your charge per unit energy drop at low energies. But because we expect this less recombination of the charge with the light, that charge is more easy to extract from the events for very low energies. And that actually compensates to some degree the Linhart factor, the poor kinematics, basically, for making very low energy, for low energy recoils making charge. So a number of these dotted curves are what Sorensen and Dahl used as plausible models for how the charge behavior, charge field behaves. And then this recent xenon 10 result uses this curve here, which is below the data significantly and fairly conservative compared to the models. And it gives us a rather stringent limit on light winds, which I believe is correct. Okay, so I'll talk a little bit about LUX to be complete. So LUX is a liquid xenon time projection chamber. There's some new steps made to go lower in radioactivity. The phototubes are about 10 millibecquerels per tube, which is nice and low.
Sorry, can I ask a question to the previous?
Yeah, sure.
So in this xenon 10 law threshold analysis, mm-hmm. you only had like order 30 events or so, I think, in the end, in the fiducialized regime. Is that also expected from krypton, or is it drastically different in xenon 100?
How much of that will be from crypto? I mean, there'll be some, they'll probably be dominated from crypto for the time being, but I'm sure that'll improve in Xenon 100. You guys are probably thinking about a low energy threshold or a low mass.
Yeah.
How are you? You're writing a paper right now. So, anyway, I'd expect you guys would have something out on that.
We will do that for this run. Yeah, the previous run with the higher crypto. And the other thing is the lower purity of the previous run. Means you have more electronegative. You have more electronegative impurities. You have more attached electrons. You can get detached.
So obviously, this depends on having a nice clean charge signal. I'm sure we'll get there. We're already there. So this approach should just keep improving because there's less background in the middle of the detector. Right. So Lux, we're building this with a titanium cryostat. We basically showed that you can buy titanium that's much lower in radioactivity than stainless steel, which is a standard way to build a cryostat. With updates in how we provide cooling power and xenon purification. We had a lot of time to tweak a lot of these approaches. We're also building Lux inside a large water shield, which is the cost-effective way to build the shielding for these bigger liquid noble gas experiments. And of course, the self-shielding is very powerful. If you look at the background, and the fiducial volume for different scale detectors, as I said, really drops exponentially with total mass of your detector. So it's very powerful. In the longest term, these detectors really only get limited by coherent neutrino scattering from atmospheric neutrinos or supernova diffuse background neutrinos. So tens of MeV neutrinos that can coherently scatter on xenon nuclei. And that will eventually limit this technology to something like 10 to minus 48 square centimeters. So, 10 years from now, 15 years from now, it'll be the end because it'll be stuck on these neutrino background. I would say the solar neutrinos don't matter for the xenon because we would love to get such a low energy threshold for that matter. We just don't deposit much energy on the xenon nucleus. So here's the Lux collaboration. It's quite sizable. Lots of expertise. Most of the xenon 10 US institutions are on Lux. And then a lot of people from the Zeppelin collaborations, Texas A&M, Rochester. We've been recently joined by Coimbra. Has a lot of background in Zeppelin 3. We've been dreaming with a number of the other Zeppelin collaborators in the UK that they'll join Lux soon as well. So here's some pretty pictures. It's all coming together. There's a very intense effort right now at the Sanford Lab in South Dakota. We have about 10 people on site at any given time putting all this together. It's quite busy, and we've done a cool down of the instrument, which went perfectly. And we're just about to start filling with the xenon at a lab at the surface. Okay. We have a very nice lab that they built first at the surface, and we're waiting for the underground infrastructure to be complete before we move the detector underground. Okay. So surface running is going on now. 2012, we're going to move underground. And I would say probably by summer 2012, we'll start taking low background data, first job. And here's our projected sensitivity for Lux over a year. It's roughly 100 kilogram fiducial over 300 days is what we predict. So we're going to really sweep through parameter space, really push through this focus point region that got a lot of people excited. So, okay, so that's xenon. Any questions on xenon stuff? Are we beginning?
What's the timeline?
So, I would expect we would get this curve sometime in 2013. We may come out with the results sooner than that as well.
Can you repeat? So eventually, if you move down, we eventually will be limited by diffuse supernova neutrino or atmospheric?
Depends on the threshold, exactly on the threshold, I think. which it's actually is. They're comparable. Depends on your model for the diffuse supernova neutrino.
So, I also have a question. So, the xenon supplies don't have like 20 kV excited states with dark matter can excite. Are there any sort of ideas that you can have some good energy resolution and extract that excitation?
We have fantastic energy resolution. I know that analyses have been done in the past on that kind of model. Wasn't done on xenon 10, I imagine it could have been. No one got around to it. The cross sections for most models are relatively small for that kind of event.
Well, I don't think it's got gathered a lot of interest.
Then again, we have lots more students now. Everyone needs a thesis. Okay, so helium. I've been thinking about helium for a long time, but the paradigm in the field has been aim for 100 JeV and get the best cross-section sensitivity you can. That's been the model for a long time. Because of inertia, that's still really the model in the field. Other than people who can think ahead of the game and work their own niche, like Quan's been doing very successfully. So it's not, as the field, as these detectors get bigger and bigger and more expensive, there's obviously this natural narrowing effect. And the question is, how many experiments do we need all focused on 100 GeV? It's going to shrink. The number of detectors is going to shrink rapidly with fewer and large international collaborations. At the same time, this conference is certainly shown others that there's so many models that predict light whiffs, and there's so much interest, driven recently by potential dark matter signals from light whiffs, that to me it looks like there's more and more interest in detectors that are dedicated for light whiffs. And so helium in the past hasn't gotten much interest because mantra has been, you need a big A square to enhance your sensitivity to WIMPs. And so no one's really pushed helium much in the past. My opinion is that you really want to look through the parameter space fully and look under every rock for the dark matter. The implications are so significant if you find it. Obviously, helium, the kinematic matching for light WIMPs or neutrino-like dark matter particles or neutrino-like particles. And basically, you get more access to the Whipple velocity distribution for your energy threshold. And all else being equally, I think you could get a comparable energy threshold in helium to that you get in xenon, for example. And if you have a variety of target masses and you have real WIMP events, then you can study the WIMP properties better if you have a range of target masses. Okay. One thing is that the Linhart effect is basically a kinematics effect. It's hard for a heavy recoil to effectively ionize electrons. And if you have a lighter mass recoil, then you get less suppression signals that are ultimately due to ionization, excitation of electrons. So 40 to 50% LFs are what you would predict in helium, those are already measured. But you can tell that can help you get a lower energy threshold for nuclear recoils. So the idea of using helium as a detector material is not new. There have been lots of clever ideas over the years. My thesis work was on an experiment to look at what's called neutrons trapped in a magnetic bottle in superfluid helium, and we basically developed a technique to measure the neutron lifetime. There's like 10 papers involved in that, but there's one of the main ones here in Nature in 2000. And then there's ongoing projects to search for the neutron electric dipole moment using liquid helium to produce the ultra-cold neutrons, store them, and then when you get an event, for example, helium-3 neutron absorption of a neutron, then you get a flash of light, and that's what you detect in this proposed experiment. This is a very large, now it's going to a very large collaboration centered at Oak Ridge in the U.S., and there are other ultra-cold neutron experiments around the world also using superfluid helium. In this case, both of these, you just used the prompt light, or S1.
But there haven't been any new, limits for
I know that.
But
nevertheless,
any of these experiments, we should say.
Those are either very hard experiments, but there's a lot of work going into them nonetheless. And I'm just pointing out that liquid helium is used as a scintillator. So there's a fair amount of work that's already gone into detecting S1 in liquid helium. And now there's a, many of you remember, there's a, one of the main ideas for how to measure the PP solar neutrino flux was using a bath of superfluid helium at 50 millikelvin. Okay. It's called Karen. A lot of work went into this, mostly at Brown University. And here's one of the early papers on that. And then the idea was to use rotons, these quasi-particle excitations in superfluid helium. And they did a lot of work and were successful in detecting good energy resolution particle events in superfluid helium using a roton signal.
So how far are they away from PPE in neutrino?
Well, the main issue there is that if you demonstrate something in a cell this big, there's a lot to go to 20 tons. And so when the solar neutrino problem was solved, a lot of the wind went out of the sails of PP neutrino searches. And so this is what was followed up on beyond the last decade. Then there's also, actually, just to complete this, there's actually ideas for wind detection of superfluid helium 3,800 microkelvin. A Grenoble group worked on that in the past. The issue there is how you get really enough target mass at 100 microkelvin, basically. But these were essentially kilometer-ish detection of the quasi-particle excitations and superfluid helium with wire resonance. Okay, so some of the chemical physics of helium, actually, it's really the same as in xenon or argon. You get your ionizing radiation event, you get excited atoms, for example. You get ionization, that ionization recombines.
We are having another laser.
Thank you. So recombine and you get these singlet molecules, which decay and give you prompt light in less than some nanoseconds. Right, it's cut off. And then you also get these triplet molecules, which in helium live for 13 seconds. Okay. And if you get excited atoms, those also react to form these molecules pretty quickly, microsecond time scale. And the molecules just sort of, these long-lived ones just sort of diffuse around in the liquid helium before the radiating decay. Yep.
Then we have a question about this process. So because it takes longer, do you also have a chance, better chance of colliding with another molecule? Is there no danger of losing some of this light because you now collide with other stuff around you?
There's actually a lot of study of this. And so you get molecules colliding with each other, which you mentioned, and then you can get called pending ionization. There's enough energy between two molecules to ionize one of them. Okay. So then you have its charge, which then recombines, but now you've turned two excitations into one. So you do lose light because of that. Okay. And we have studies of that with alpha particles, actually. I have a paper from like 2003 where I studied alpha particle excitation. And we can see this effect of pending ionization. That will be there to some degree for nuclear recoils. Okay. But it's probably not very severe, given the excitation density, especially for low energy recoils. And may actually be able to use in our favor. The more different we can make electron and nuclear recoils, the better for discrimination power. So you get these excimers. Basically, if you, in the long distance separation between the two atoms, this turns into an excited atom and a ground state atom, bring them together and get these bound states. When they radiate the decay, you get a band of fluorescence centered at 80 nanometers. And that's true for the triplet states as well. Okay, so what's the basic idea that I'm toying with? It's basically a liquid helium time projection chamber. So obviously good kinematics for light wimps, very easy purification, a homogeneous detector volume like in the heavier noble liquid experiments, and helium is completely free of some radioactivity. And there's a lot of signals. Look at superfluid helium, there's just a lot there. there's prompt light, there's charge, there's these triplet molecules, so I've been calling these S1 and S2, just like in the xenon and argon detectors, and then I've been calling S3, this triplet molecule signal. And then S4, S5, whatever, from rotons, phonons, quantum turbulence that a particle produces in helium. And so the ratios of these very likely give powerful discrimination power, just no one's measured it yet. Okay? So that's really the key piece of R&D that's missing right now. Is how good is the discrimination looking at the ratios of these different signals? And I would say...
Is it that you also need a very low rate in principle then, because you have so different time scales in your different...
Oh, I'll explain how to get these. Yeah. So, actually, so there'll be a paper out on the archive next week. It was submitted yesterday, where we just did some measurements at Yale of charge extraction, of charge separation in liquid helium. The physics is of the electrons in the noble liquid is a bit different in liquid helium and liquid neon than it is for the heaviers. Basically, the electron makes this bubble state, pushes away other atoms, and it gives a larger effective mass than in liquid xenon and liquid argon, where there's actually a band gap. And so the charge drift is slower. This has been studied less, and it's harder to separate the charge in the entire field. We basically applied field here in the liquid and studied how much the prompt light was suppressed by application of the field, and that tells you how much charge you separated. So we did some studies, basically of Monte Carlo studies of how for different average ion electron separations, the question, if you have an ionization event, how far does the electron go in the liquid before it comes to rest? And the ability of the electric field to separate the charge depends very sensitively on that mean separation. Okay, so you can know Monte Carlo looking at how different fields would affect the recombination or 1 minus that escape probability. We measured how much the light signal is quenched by different electric fields. So here's some data at 2.7 kilovolts per centimeter, and we saw definite shifts in the light production, which is quantified here. And if you work out the recombination probability and this average electron ion separation. And so that allows us to now predict for different electric fields how much charge we can separate in liquid helium. So this is a new development. It basically points to, we need more field in liquid helium to get a sizable ionization signal, but it's nothing crazy. You know, it's kilovolts per centimeter, 5 kilovolts per centimeter. I should mention that those neutron EDM experiments I was talking about are already getting like 30 kilovolts per centimeter in their instruments and aiming for more like 50 kilovolts per centimeter. So the requirements here are relatively benign. I mean, it's certainly doable to get the fields we need to do a dark matter experiment with helium. Okay, so how to detect that charge signal? Well, again, there are lots of ideas, I think most of which are likely to work. You can do proportional scintillation like we do in xenon and argon two-phase. There's also, you can use gas electron multipliers. Those have been shown to work at low temperature in helium. Microregus, but then it's a different similar sort of redox scheme, would also likely work. And then I'm also getting interested in, can you actually just have very thin wires in the liquid helium? If the electron gets close to the wire, then you can get electroluminescence, basically a breakdown of the wire, which produces light, which you can detect. This electroluminescence actually for xenon 100 limited the cathode field that you put on the detector. So in those cases, it's actually troublesome. In this case, it might actually be useful for extracting the signal without applying high electric fields in the gaseous helium, which is more prone to breakdown than in the heavy noble gases. So this could be, I'm excited about this approach, which avoids any high fields in the gas. Well, the charge drift is slower in helium, sort of centimeter per millisecond, okay, so a couple orders of magnitude lower than in xenon and argon. Okay. However, if you think about background rates, typical from PMTs and the shielding material, this looks fine in terms of avoiding pileup, even with the 100 kilogram scale. And so I think that while pileup is more of a worry in helium than in xenon, I'd say it's less of a worry than in liquid argon, where you have all this argon 39. So that looks manageable. So in all of these cases, the idea is you change the charge signal into a light signal somehow and read out the same photodetectors that are reading the prompt, S1 light. I also mentioned that it can actually be an advantage if the charge drift is slow, because then your S2 signal is spread over a longer time scale, and you can really count individual electrons as they hit the wire or hit the gem. And that can improve your energy resolution by counting electrons instead of averaging over a lot of combined signal. So here's a very simple schematic. Here, using phototubes. Phototubes have been shown to work at 4 Kelvin. And I think you probably would not put them in the liquid helium directly.
Why not?
Well, I know that they'll work at 4 Kelvin. I don't know that they'll work at 1.5. It's something we can test. The other thing is that helium, gaseous helium at room temperature, is instant death for a phototube. We have to go to all sorts of pain to make sure that our phototubes are never in the same room if we're doing helium leak checking, for example. Helium will diffuse right in and destroy the vacuum of a phototube. It's something we have to take a lot of care in. Lots and other experiments. Now, once you're cold, that diffusion shuts off. So you can imagine putting phototubes inside, cooling down the nitrogen temperature, and then pumping it out and then putting in helium, and that would probably work. And phototubes would probably be fine, but it's just an extra step. So I think one thing we want to study is putting phototubes in the helium. So it's a simple thing. You get an S1 pulse, the electric charge drifts up, you get light here, or however you decide to read out the charge up here.
Maybe if you're going to have some of them in, some of them out, you can have a better control. If you have some of them in, some of them out. If you have some of the PMTs in and some of them outside, you can have a much better control over what part is surface, right? Because you know where the signal, which ones the signal came from.
It's nice to get these phototubes as close as possible to where the S2 is produced, because that affects your position resolution. So are you saying that these are especially good to be able to put inside the gas?
The
thing is, if you've solved it for one set of PMTs, you've solved it for the rest. But it's all, there's a lot of phase space to explore. Oh, I wanted to, I guess I'm almost out of time. I do have a project at Yale where we study these triplet molecules. Here's a paper from 99 where we did this first measurement of the triplet molecule lifetime liquid helium. I had a source in liquid helium, I pulled it out, and the signal didn't drop immediately. It was funny decay. And we eventually figured out it was doing these molecules. And then there's actually a lot of study in the 60s and 70s on spectroscopy of these triplet molecules in liquid helium. So you can see electronic transitions, you can drive electronic transitions in these molecules, you can see vibrational structure in these. And in 2005, I proposed that you could actually detect these molecules optically, pulse laser. You put in a pulse, drive a two-photon transition, and then it fluoresces at 640 nanometers. non-rearview decays back here, and then you can do this over and again and cycle this transition like they do in atomic tracks. And the idea is that you could use this for WIMPs, ultracold neutrons, gamma stuff, and also quantum turbulence visualization in liquid helium. I have Packard Foundation support for this, actually some DOD money in the US, and now we have NSF money to work this last thing. Anyway, some relatively simple cryogenic systems at Yale, optical cells and lasers. And we would basically shine a laser beam through the superfluid helium cell of a radioactive source there and do spectroscopy. We worked out where the ideal wavelengths of the laser to drive the cycling transition and looked at the light coming out and the signal from that upper state decaying. And that works pretty well. We did find that we need to up what they can atomic physics business call repumping, put in lasers to drive the molecules to the state where they're most sensitive to the laser, make sure that they're not in the wrong vibrational state, for example. So we can actually keep our signal consistently high by doing this repumping of the molecules. And here are some images of many beta tracks laid on top of each other, for example, using a CCD camera and laser-induced fluorescence. We also did Compton imaging, Compton scattering experiments, just making Compton electrons. You can get images of tracks of electrons using this technique. And then some more recent things we've been doing is we've been basically producing clouds of these molecules with a pulsed needle. So we can make a cloud of a billion excimers at the end of a needle. And we can push that cloud through superfluid helium using heat. So if you turn on a heater, you get phonons and rotons, which go away from the source of heat and push impurities through the helium. And so we were able to do this with clouds of these helium excimers and push them down a channel, thereby measure the velocity of the normal fluid and superfluid helium. And here's some images of lines of molecules we produced and tagged, and watching those get pushed through the channel in the heat. And here's some images of these helium clouds and measurements of their velocity in the superfluid. So here's a recent paper in PRL. We're also working with some folks in the UK and at Florida, experts in quantum turbulence. The idea that these excimers can capture on quantum turbulence and then be imaged like pearls on a string, basically, using our new technique. Using our new approach. And so we have an experiment on a rotating dilution refrigerator system at Manchester University, where we produce a bunch of molecules at one point, suppress any charge from coming through the superfluid helium cell, detect the molecules on the other side, and look at how that rate depends on the rate that you're spinning the entire system, basically on the rate on the amount of quantum turbulence in between. And so we can see that that rate drop, which is evidence of the molecules being captured on quantum turbulence in the superfluid. So we're writing this up. And also we have pulse measurements, so we can pulse the needle, bang, and then watch the molecules appear on the other side, some 5 centimeters away. And in that case, we're measuring the velocity of the molecules in the helium, which is so they're growing at about 1 meter per second in the superfluid. So how to detect these molecules? Okay, so there are, again, several approaches. One is you can use laser-induced fluorescence. Main issue there, I mean, technically demonstrated, the main issue there is that you really need a lot of laser power to drive molecules that we were doing. And so detecting single molecules in a big detector, I think, could be difficult. And then we're thinking about drifting molecules with a heat flux. Basically, you know, instead of drifting electrons with an electric field, we can push them around with heat. If you make them quench on the surface, each one is holding about 18 eV. They're little bombs. They hit a surface. You can also then extract ionization from them, like we're doing in the Manchester experiment. And then something I'm really excited about right now, and I actually was debating even mentioning it because I kind of want to keep it under wraps. But anyway, so the idea is to use a bolometer array immersed in the superfluid. And then you should be able to detect individual photons. And you can use that to detect the helium molecules when they hit the belongings. And those, in principle, could be able to read out S1, S2, and S3 in a small kilogram scale detector. So we're working on that. We'll probably write something up in the next month or so about the concept or concepts. So summary, okay, I talked about liquid xenon detectors and the charge only technique especially. And then the background on liquid helium for dark matter detection. There is a fair amount of work on liquid helium for particle detection already, just not applied to dark matter. And there are a lot of different kinds of signals available. Superfluid helium is incredibly rich. And we have new results showing that charge signal may be had with reasonable fields. So that's promising. And the main thing is the R&D on how much of these different signals do you get from nuclear recoils? How much light, how much charge, how many triplet molecules from a nuclear recoil compared to a gamma ray? And so we're working on a concept paper on this. I think you can imagine that given the limits at light wimps, even a kilogram of liquid helium could do some very interesting physics. It's nice to be able to think of a small detector that can have a high impact. So, that's it. Thank you.
Yeah, we're right. If we you scatter air wind for 9 kilonucleus, the nucleus will get a recoil of maximum 10 kV, roughly. Right?
Sure.
But in the model that we discussed yesterday with Joseph, you have a more interacting neutrino, you can get it up to 75 kV. Is there any gain having a larger recoil?
Of course, yeah. The more signals you have, the more information you have for a band, the better discrimination power. It makes a huge difference. It would stick right out.
So, in your best case scenario, what are the counting rates? Would you ever be able to achieve for the, say, electronic recoil?
That depends so strongly on the discrimination power. Mm-hmm. I mean, in 2003, we knew nothing about discrimination in liquid xenon. This is about where we are in helium. We're about 8 years behind xenon. It's incredibly strong on how well you can discriminate. So I decided not to put up any exclusion curves for that reason, because I'm just really, really speculative. But I think there's very good reason that, given that the other noble liquids, so very large, sizable differences in their signals for different kinds of events, that the same will be true for helium. There are every reason to believe that. And the question is this 99% discrimination? Or is it 99.99999% discrimination? A lot depends on where you sit. But we do have so many signals in helium, I think it's pretty likely that some combination will work.
And maybe following up on the same question, a while ago we had this model and Sim and Gene also were this kind of model. They had their own suggestions about it's very easy to keep a stable or a very metastable state of dark matter. The only way you'll detect it is because when it goes through a detector, it can actually de-excite. And it turns out that the lighter element detectors are actually better at detecting that.
Oh, really?
And if you can go up to an MeV of the separation, that's very well motivated because it basically will have nothing to decay to, 2 times the electron mass. And so if you can detect signals up to 900 kV or so, that's you'll be the forerunner of excluding those sort of things.
I mean, if it's a gamma, I assume.
It will just be a nuclear recoil.
Oh, okay, yeah. So that'll just differ. I mean, obviously, the masses here are far less than the xenon detectors or argon detectors. So we'll trade that off.
have one more question. The S real, what is the, maybe you said already, what is the lifetime of that? What is the lifetime of that state?
If you have relatively high temperature liquid helium, like 1 to 2 Kelvin,
okay,
that excimer will go millimeters in its lifetime, and will radiate and decay. Okay. If you apply a heat flux, then you can push that molecule where you want it.
Uh-huh.
Okay. With velocities, I think meter per second is quite reasonable.
So you can get
and then you can quench it on the surface. Basically, if you have a cooled surface, the molecule will get banged into that surface. You apply an electric field, you extract the charge. Okay? And then you detect that charge the same way that you detect S2. Okay? So that's how you could detect the S3 signal in relatively warm liquid helium. And then if you went to CDMS level temperatures or crest temperatures, then those molecules will actually move ballistically through the helium. They're not scattering with anything. They're like moving through a vacuum. When they hit a surface, they quench. I mentioned directionality and some things in my 2005 paper. The Heron folks also pointed out that some of the signals in the helium you can expect to be emitted not isotropically with the from the track. The roton signal, that's true. I think that's also true for the excimer signal. It will be emitted perpendicular to the track. It's like you have a cigar, and it's scattering in the cigar. It's most likely you get out and leave perpendicular to the excitation track. Obviously, that would be another thing that would have to be studied for anyone to take it seriously.
Okay, I think you should really hire a grad student for coming up with cool names for all of those experiments you propose.
I should also there's a fair amount of growing interest in this for as an experiment. Or at least R&D for now. So I'm hoping that we can start accelerating this. Frankly, it's very hard to get the agency to give you support for more than one experiment at a time. And we have a lot of commitments on bus.
Okay, we leave it there. Let's thank Dan again.